windshield and remember where I am and what has happened. The deer is lying in the road, screened by the white veil of the headlights. I stumble out of the car. In the pouring rain, I kneel down and touch its face, its neck. Then I start to sob. I am so distraught that it takes me a moment to realize that there is another car illuminating the night, a hand gentle on my shoulder. "Miss?" the policeman asks. "Are you all right?" As if that were an easy answer. As if I could reply with a single word. After the cops call Mary, she insists on getting me checked out at a hospital. When the doctor puts a butterfly bandage on my forehead and tells her I ought to be watched for signs of concussion, she announces I will be staying overnight at her house and does not allow me to argue. By then, my head hurts so much I am in no condition to put up a fight, which is how I wind up in Mary's kitchen drinking tea. Mary's hands are covered with dried purple paint. She'd been working on a mural when she was contacted by the police. The painting surrounds me, on the walls of the breakfast nook, a half-finished dreamscape of the apocalypse. Jesus, I'm guessing it's Jesus anyway, because he's got the long hair and the beard, but his face looks suspiciously like Bradley Cooper's, is holding out his hand to those tumbling toward Mephistopheles, who is female and resembles Michelle Bachmann. The poor souls who are falling are in various states of undress, and some are still just roughly sketched before I can make out the features of Snooki, Donald Trump, Joe Paterno. I touch my finger to the spot on the mural just behind my back. "Elmo?" I say. "Really? How long has he been a toddler?" Mary asks, shrugging as she passes me the sugar. "He never gets old. Clearly he made a deal with the devil." She holds my hand across the table. "It means a lot to me, you know, that you called me." I choose not to point out that the police were the ones who called. "I thought you were angry at me because I told you to take time off, but really it's for your own good, Sage." She smiles a little. "Sister Immaculata used to say that to me all the time when I was a kindergartner in parochial school. I never stopped talking. So one day she put me in the trash can. I was short enough that I fit. Every time I complained, she kicked the can." "I'm supposed to be grateful that you didn't throw me in the dumpster?" "No, you're supposed to be grateful that someone cares enough about you to help you get back on track again. You know it's what your mother would have wanted." My mother. The reason I had gone to grief group in the first place. If she hadn't died, I might never have cultivated a friendship with Joseph Weber. "So what happened tonight?" Mary asks. "Well, that's a loaded question. You know, I hit a deer and my car swerved into the guardrail." "Where were you headed? The weather was awful." "Home," I say, because that isn't a lie. I would like to tell her all about Joseph, but she already dismissed me once when I tried to confide in her. It's like he said, we believe what we want to, what we need to. The corollary is that we choose not to see what we'd rather pretend doesn't exist. Mary can't accept the thought that Joseph Weber might be a monster, because that implies that she was duped by him. "Were you with him?" Mary asks tightly. At first I think she is talking about Joseph, but then I realize she means Adam. "Actually, I told Adam I didn't want to see him for a while." Mary's jaw drops. "Amen!" "But then I drove to his house." When Mary buries her face in her hands, I grimace. I wasn't going to go inside, I swear it. "Hello? Why didn't you come here?" Mary asks. "I have enough herbal tea in Häagen-Dazs to compensate for any breakup, and I'm more emotionally available than Adam ever was." I nod. "You're right. I should have called you. But instead, I saw him with his wife and kids. I got rattled, I guess. And I was distracted, which is why I hit the deer." I realize that I've crafted this entire story without even mentioning Joseph's name. I have more in common with my grandmother than I originally thought. "Nice try," Mary says, "but you're lying." I blink at her, my breath caught in my throat. "I know you. You were driving to see him because you wanted to tell him you'd made a mistake. If you hadn't peeping Tom the whole happy family scene, you probably would have climbed a trellis and thrown pebbles at the window until he came outside to talk to you." I scowl at her. "You make me sound like such a loser." Mary shrugs. "Look, all I'm saying is that it wouldn't hurt you to hold a grudge longer than a single breath." Isn't that a little Old Testament for a nun? Ex-nun. And let me tell you, that serenity crap from The Sound of Music? Bullshit. Inside the cloister, the sisters are just as petty as people on the outside. There are some you love and some you hate. I did my share of spitting in the holy water font before another nun used it. It was totally worth the 20 rosaries I said for penance. I rub my left temple, which is throbbing. "Can you get me my phone?" She gets up and rummages through my purse to find it for me. "Who are you calling?" "Pepper." "Liar. The last time you talked to your sister, she hung up on you because you said tutoring a 4-year-old to get into an exclusive preschool made as much sense as hiring a swim coach for a guppy. You wouldn't call Pepper if you were trapped in the car and it was about to catch fire. Just let me check my messages, will you?" Mary thrusts the phone at me. "Go ahead, text him. By tomorrow morning, you're going to be begging him to forgive you anyway. It's your M.O. I scan my contacts for Leo's number. "Not this time, I promise." Apparently, even Nazi hunters take a breather. Although I leave 3 voicemails for Leo that night and the next morning, he does not answer, and he does not call me back. I fall into a fitful sleep in Mary's guest bedroom, where an elaborate carving of Jesus carrying his cross hangs over my head. I dream that I have to drag a crucifix up a Sisyphean hill and look down from its peak to see the bodies of thousands of naked men, women, children. Mary drives me home on her way to the bakery, even though I insist that it would just be better for me to join her there. Once I'm back in my house, though, I'm restless. I don't think I can handle another session with Joseph today. I don't want to talk to him until I have connected with Leo anyway. I want to get my mind off Joseph, so I decide to bake something that requires my undevoted attention. Brioche. It's a bread that is an anomaly. 50% of it is butter. Yet instead of being a brick of a loaf, it is melt in your mouth, sweet, airy. To make it on a hot, humid day like this is an added challenge, because it requires all ingredients to be cold. I even refrigerate the mixing bowl and the dough hook. I begin by beating the butter with a rolling pin while the dough is mixing. Then I add it in small portions to the mixer. This is my favorite part about brioche. The dough doesn't quite know what to do with all that butter and begins to come apart. But with enough time, it manages to bring itself back to center, to a satin consistency. I turn off the mixer and rip off a hunk of dough the size of a plum. Holding it between my hands, I pull it slowly to see if it sheets, growing transparent as it stretches. I set the dough into a container and cover it tightly with plastic wrap, then place it on my counter and begin to clean up the kitchen. The doorbell rings. The sound startles me. I'm not home during the day, usually, and no one ever rings the doorbell at night. Even Adam, when he comes, has his own key. I'm expecting the mail lady or the UPS guy, but the man standing on my porch is not in uniform. He's wearing a rumpled suit jacket and a tie, even though it's easily 85 degrees out. He has black hair and beard stubble, and eyes the color of polished walnut. And he's easily 6'3". "Sage Singer," he says, when I open the door. "I'm Leo Stein." He is not what I anticipated, in more ways than one. Immediately, I shake my bangs forward to cover my face, but I can tell I'm too late. Leo is staring at me, as if he can see through the screen of hair. How did you know where I live? I ask.
Are you kidding? We're the Department of Justice. I know what you had for breakfast this morning.
Really?
No.
He grins, and it takes me by surprise. I would think a person like him doesn't smile very often. I would think, given all he's heard, that he's forgotten how.
Could I come in?
I don't know if there's a protocol here, if I'm even allowed to turn him away. I wonder if I've done something terribly wrong, if there have been hidden cameras focused on me and Joseph, if I'm in trouble.
Okay, the first thing you have to do is breathe, Leo says. I'm here to help you, not arrest you.
I turn in profile so that he can't see the bad side of my face.
He says, is something wrong?
No, why?
Because you're twisted the way I was when I fell asleep at my desk last month. I couldn't straighten my neck for a week.
I take a deep breath and meet his gaze, challenging him to look at me.
Oh, he says softly. Well, that's not what I expected. I don't know why I feel like I've been slapped. Most polite people do not say anything at all when they see my scars. If Leo had done that, at least I could have pretended he didn't notice.
It's silly, but I pictured you with brown eyes, not blue, he says.
My mouth drops open.
I like the blue, though, Leo adds. It suits you.
That's all you have to say? I reply.
Really?
He shrugs.
If you were thinking I'd run away screaming because you have a few silver cyborg lines on your face, I'm sorry to disappoint you.
Cyborg?
Look, I don't know you very well, but you seem a little fixated on physical appearance. That's far less interesting to me than the fact that you brought Joseph Weber to my attention.
At the mention of Joseph's name, I shake my head to clear it. I talked to him yesterday. He's done so many horrible things. Leo reaches into a battered briefcase and takes out a file.
I know, he says. That's why I thought it was time for us to meet each other.
But you said I would have to talk to one of your historians.
A flush works its way up his neck. I was in the neighborhood, he says.
You were in New Hampshire for something else?
Philly, he replies. Close enough.
Philly is 8 hours away by car. I step back, holding the door. Well then, I reply. You must be hungry. Leo Stein cannot stop eating the brioche. The first batch has come out of the oven, impossibly light. I serve it warm, with jam and tea.
Mmm, he rhapsodizes, his eyes closing in delight. I've never tasted anything like this.
They don't have bakeries in Washington?
I wouldn't know. My sustenance consists of really bad coffee and sandwiches that come out of a vending machine.
I have spent the past 2 hours telling Leo everything Joseph told me. In between, I have shaped the brioche into a traditional tete, brushed it with an egg wash, and baked it. It's easier for me to talk when my hands are busy. With each word that passes my lips, I feel less heavy. It is as if I am giving him sentences made of stones, and the more I relay, the more of the burden he is carrying. He takes notes and writes on his legal pad. He scrutinizes the clipping I slipped into my pocket before I left Joseph, the one of him eating his mother's cake that ran in the local paper in Wavelsburg. And he doesn't even do a double take when he looks at me.
Are you going to talk to him directly? I ask.
Leo looks up at me.
Not yet. You've developed a good rapport. He trusts you.
He trusts me to forgive him, I say. Not to turn him in.
Forgiveness is spiritual. Punishment is legal, Leo says. They're not mutually exclusive.
So you'd forgive him?
I didn't say that.
It's not my place or yours, if you ask me. Forgiveness is the imitation of God.
So is punishment, I point out.
He raises his brows and smiles. The difference is that God never hates.
I'm surprised you can believe in God after meeting so many evil people.
How could I not? Leo asks, after meeting so many survivors.
He wipes his mouth with his napkin.
So you saw his tattoo?
He clarifies.
I saw a mark that could have been a tattoo.
Where?
Leo holds up his arm. Show me.
I touch his left biceps muscle, below the armpit. I can feel the heat of his skin through the cotton of his shirt. Here. It looked like a cigarette burn.
That's consistent with Waffen SS Blutgruppe tattoos, Leo says. And with the file we've got so far. As is his claim that he was with the 1st SS Infantry Brigade in 1941, and that he worked at Auschwitz II after 1943.
He opens the folder on the table between us. I see a grainy photograph of a young man in a Nazi uniform, with skulls on the lapels of his coat. It could be Joseph, I suppose, but I can't tell.
Hartmann, Reiner,
I read, peeking as he slips the photograph from its paperclip. There is an address in spiky handwriting I cannot read, and the letters AB, which must be his blood type. Leo closes the folder quickly, classified information, I suppose, and sets the photo beside the newspaper clipping.
The question is, are these the same guy?
In the first, Joseph is a young boy. In the second, he's a man. The quality of both photos is shoddy at best. I can't tell. But does it really matter? I mean, if all the other stuff he's said fits?
Well, Leo answers, that depends. In 1981, the Supreme Court concluded that anyone who was a guard at a Nazi concentration camp took part in supporting the activities that occurred there, including murder, if we're talking about Auschwitz II. The court's analysis was reminiscent of a trial in Germany years earlier, in which a suspect said that if German authorities prosecuted him, they should prosecute everyone at the camp, because the camp operated as a chain of functions, and everyone in that chain had to perform his function, or the whole apparatus of annihilation would have ground to a halt. So everyone from the guards to the bean counters at Auschwitz is culpable for what happened there, simply because they were aware of what was going on inside its fences and performed their duties. Think about it like this. Let's say you and your boyfriend decide to kill me in my office. The deal is that your boyfriend is going to chase me around the room with a knife while you stand outside holding the door closed so I can't escape. Both of you are going down for murder one. It's just a division of labor about how you each participated.
I don't have a boyfriend, I blurt out. It turns out that it is easier to say aloud than I would have expected, and instead of feeling as if my heart has been ripped out of my chest, it seems as if I am made out of helium. I mean, I did, but things aren't... I shrug. Anyway, he won't be killing you in your office anytime soon.
Leo blushes. Guess that means I'll be able to sleep well tonight.
I clear my throat.
So all we have to do is prove that Joseph worked at Auschwitz, I say.
If he's confessed to that, isn't it enough?
That depends on how trustworthy his confession is.
Why would any court think he'd lie about that?
Why does anyone lie? Leo says. He's old. He's got mental issues. He's a masochist. Who knows? For all we know, he wasn't even there. He could have read a book and regurgitated that history to you, but that doesn't mean it's his own.
Even though you have a file with his name on it.
He's already given you one false name, Leo points out. This could be another.
So how do we make sure he's really Reiner?
There are two ways, Leo says. Either he has to keep talking to you and eventually spill information that's inside this file, up-close SS information that isn't the kind of stuff you can glean from watching the History Channel 24/7. Or, We need an eyewitness who remembers him from the camp.
He touches the newspaper clipping and the Nazi Party registration photo. Someone who could say that these two men are one and the same.
I look at the loaf of brioche, no longer steaming but fragrant and warm, the jam staining the maple table. My grandmother told me that her father used to ask her a riddle. What must you break apart in order to bring a family close together?
Bread, of course. I think of this, and even though I am not religious, I pray that she will forgive me.
I think I know someone who can help, I say.
Say what you want, Damien argued. I'm only trying to keep you safe.
I had opened the door, expecting Alex, only to find the captain of the guard instead. I had told him I was busy, and this was true. This week, business had grown stronger. We couldn't produce enough baguettes to feed demand. The loaves, like my rolls, were sweeter than anything my father had ever baked. Alex joked with me and said he had a secret ingredient, but he wouldn't tell me what it was. Then it would only be an ingredient, he said. Now I listened to Damien as he lectured me in my kitchen. An oupure, I said. Those are folk tales.
There's a reason tales get told. What else makes sense? The livestock was one thing, Anya, but this beast is going after humans.
I had heard of them, of course, of the undead who rose from their coffins, unsatisfied, and gorged themselves on the blood of others. An oupure would eat its own flesh if it had to. Old Sal, who sold baskets in the village square, was superstitious. She never walked near a black cat. She threw salt over her shoulder. She wore her clothes inside out the night of the full moon. She was the one who buzzed about this oupure that was terrorizing our village, whispering every time we set up shop beside each other at market. "You can spot them in a crowd," she had said. "They live among us, with their ruddy cheeks and their red lips. And after their death, they complete their transformation. If that's already happened, it's too late. The only way to kill an oupure is to cut off its head or cleave open its heart. And the only way to protect yourself from one is to swallow its blood." I had dismissed old Sal's stories, and now I would dismiss Damien's. I folded my arms. "What is it you want me to do, then?"
"It's said that you can catch an oupure if you can distract it," he explained. "Once it sees a knot, it has to untie it. If there's a pile of seeds, it has to count them." Damien reached above my head, took a bag of barley grain and dumped it on the counter.
"And why would the oupure happen to wander into my bakery?"
"It's possible," Damien said, "that he's already here."
It took me a moment to understand, and then I was furious.
"So because he's an outsider, he's the easy target? Because he didn't go to school with you like all your soldier friends, or because he has a different way of pronouncing words? He's not a monster, Damien, he's just different."
"Do you really know that?" he challenged, backing me up against the wall of the brick oven. "His arrival coincided with the killings."
"He's here all night and at home with his brother all day. When would he even have time to do the things you claim?"
"Are you with him while he's working, watching him? Or are you asleep?"
I opened my mouth. The truth was, I had been spending more and more time in the kitchen with Alex. I told him about my father and about Baruch Beiler. He told me about how he'd wanted to be an architect, designing buildings so tall that you became dizzy standing on the top floors. Occasionally I fell asleep curled at the table, but when I did, I always awakened to find that Alex had carried me to my bed. Sometimes I thought that I liked staying up late with him because I knew he'd do that. I started to sweep the barley up with my hands, but Damien caught my wrist.
"If you're so sure, then why not leave it and see what happens?"
I thought of Alex running with his brother from town to town. I thought of his hands at my throat, sewing me whole again. I met Damien's eyes.
"All right," I said.
That night,
I didn't meet Alex in the kitchen. I wasn't even there when he let himself inside. Instead, when he knocked softly on my bedroom door, I told him I was feeling ill and wanted to rest. But I didn't.
I imagined him distracted by the barley, sorting it into piles.
I imagined blood on his hands and pooling in his mouth. When I couldn't sleep, I lit a candle and crept down the hall to the kitchen. I felt the heat through the wooden door, radiant from the oven. If I stood on my toes, I could peer through a chink in the wood. I wouldn't have a panoramic view of the kitchen, but maybe I could see Alex working as he usually did, allaying my worst fears. I had a perfect view of the butcher block table, with the bag of barley still spilled on its side. But the pile of grains had been organized, seed by seed, into military formation. The door swung open so suddenly I fell inside, landing on all fours. The candle I was carrying rolled out of its holder and skittered across the stone floor. As I reached for it, Alex's boot stepped down, extinguishing the flame.
Spying on me?
I scrambled to my feet and shook my head. My gaze was drawn to the barley in neat rows.
I'm a little behind in my baking, Alex said. I had a mess to clean up when I arrived.
I realized that he was bleeding. A bandage was wrapped around his forearm. You're hurt.
It's nothing.
He looked like the man I had laughed with yesterday when he did his impression of the town drunk. He looked like the man who had lifted me into his arms when I saw a mouse skitter across the floor and refused to walk in the kitchen until I was sure it had been caught. He was so close now that I could smell peppermint on his breath. I could see the flecks of green in the molten gold of his eyes. I swallowed. Are you what I think you are?
Alex didn't blink. Would it matter?
When he kissed me, I felt like I was being consumed. I was rising, expanding from the inside, frustrated that there was skin between us, that I couldn't get closer. I clawed at the small of his back, my fingers slipping beneath his shirt. He held my head in the cradle of his hands, and gently, so gently that I didn't even feel it, he bit my lip. There was blood in my mouth and on his. It tasted like metal, like pain. I pulled away from him, drinking the taste of myself for the first time. In retrospect, I could only think that he was as shaken by the moment as I was, or surely he would have heard the approach of Damien, who flung open the door with his soldiers, their bayonets trained on us.
Leo. The reason that we go to meet the people who bring us plausible tips about potential Nazis is so that we can make sure they aren't nuts. You can usually get a good reading in a few moments about whether your informant is balanced and sane, or whether she's acting on a grudge, is paranoid, or is just plain crazy. Within moments of meeting Sage Singer, I know this. She isn't trying to frame this Joseph Weber guy. She has nothing to gain from turning him in. She's incredibly sensitive because she has a scar that ripples from her left eyebrow down her cheek. Also, because of said scar, she has no idea that she's incredibly hot. I get it, really, I do. When I was 13, I had the worst case of acne. I swear my pimples gave birth to smaller pimples. I got called Pepperoni Face or Luigi because that was the name of the guy who owned the pizzeria in my hometown. On school picture day, I was so nervous about having my image captured for eternity that I actually willed myself into throwing up so I could stay home. My mother told me that when I was older, I'd teach people to never judge a book by its cover, and that's pretty much exactly what my job entails. But sometimes, when I glance in the mirror even now, I feel like I'm still staring at that kid. I bet whatever Sage is picturing when she looks at her reflection is a lot worse than what the rest of us actually see. Ginevra is the one who is dispatched to vet most of the cold callers who reach our department, I've only met two or three. They were all in their 80s, Jews who still saw the faces of their captors superimposed on everyone they happened to meet. In none of those cases did the allegation pan out to be correct. Sage Singer is not 80 years old. And she's not lying, either. Your grandmother, I repeat. She's a survivor? Sage nods. And somehow in the past four conversations I've had with you, that never came up? I'm still trying to figure out if this is a very good thing or a very bad thing. If Sage's grandmother is willing and able to identify Rainer Hartmann as an officer at Auschwitz-Birkenau, that would be a direct link between the file Ginevra's amassed and the information Sage has culled from the suspect. But if Sage has predisposed her grandmother in any way to the suspect by saying, for example, that she had been talking to him, then any eyewitness testimony given is prejudicial. I didn't want you to think that was why I called you. It had nothing to do with my grandmother. She never talks about her experience, ever. I lean forward, clasping my hands. So you haven't told her about your meetings with Joseph Weber? No, Sage says. She doesn't even know he exists. And she's never discussed her time at Auschwitz with you? Sage shakes her head. Even when I've asked her specifically, she won't talk about it. She looks up at me. Is that normal? I don't know that there's anything normal about being a survivor, I say. Some feel that because they lived, it's their responsibility to tell the world what happened so it won't happen again and so people won't forget. Others believe that the only way to go on with the rest of their lives is to act as if it never happened. I sweep my crumbs into my napkin and carry my plate to the sink. Well, I say, thinking out loud, I can give my historian a call. She can get a photo array cobbled together in a few hours, and then she won't talk to you either, Sage says. I smile. Grandmothers find me especially charming. She folds her arms. If you hurt her, I'll... Note to self, don't threaten a federal agent. And second note to self, don't worry. I give you my word. I won't push her if she isn't able to open up about it. And if she does, then what? You arrest Joseph? I shake my head. We don't have any criminal jurisdiction over Nazis, I explain. We can't incarcerate your man or set him free. The crimes took place outside the United States long before we had extraterritorial jurisdiction statutes. It wasn't until 2007 that the U.S. Genocide Statute was amended to cover more than genocides perpetrated by U.S. citizens other than General Custer's actions against the Native Americans. All we can do is try to catch him on immigration charges and get him deported. And even then, I've been trying for years to get Europeans to develop a moral backbone and take Nazis back and prosecute, and it hardly ever happens. So we're doing all this for nothing? Sage asks. We're doing all this because your grandmother made her home in the United States, and we owe her peace of mind. Sage looks at me for a long moment. Okay, she says. I'll take you to her condo. There are things in Rainer Hartmann's file that Sage Singer doesn't know about. It's my job to tell her as little as possible, to instead coax out of her what she can tell me. And even then, I can't be sure that a court will be able to connect the dots and prosecute him. I can't be sure that Hartmann will survive long enough to receive his comeuppance. So far, what Sage has relayed to me is information that could be gleaned from the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum archives or from poring through a book. Military actions and dates, company units, career trajectories. Even the blood group tattoos are something you'd know about if you study Third Reich history. As untenable as it seems that someone is making up a false, guilty identity, stranger things have happened. But in this file, there are specifics about Rainer Hartmann that only Rainer Hartmann and his superiors and maybe his closest confidants should know. None of which Sage Singer has said yet. Which could mean that Joseph Weber hasn't gotten around to telling her those stories. Or that Joseph Weber isn't Rainer Hartmann. At any rate, getting an ID from Sage's grandmother Minka is just one more piece of the puzzle. Which is how I find myself driving back toward Boston, on the exact same route I just traveled from Logan Airport to New Hampshire, with Sage sitting beside me in the car. "That's a new one," I say. "No one in my department has ever been so upset by a testimony that they went out and hit a deer with their car." "It wasn't intentional," Sage mutters. "A big isn't." "I beg your pardon?" I turn to her. "It means so long, your health. You don't speak Yiddish, I guess." "I'm not Jewish, I told you that." Actually, she had asked me if it mattered. "Oh," I say, "I just assumed morality has nothing to do with religion," she says. "You can do the right thing and not believe in God at all." "So you're an atheist?" "I don't like labels." "I imagine you wouldn't, growing up here. Doesn't exactly look like a diverse religious community." "That's probably why it took Joseph so long to find someone from a Jewish family," Sage says. "Well, it doesn't really matter, since you're not going to forgive him." She's silent. "You're not," I repeat, my jaw dropping. "Are you?" "I don't want to. But there's a part of me that says he's just an old, frail man. One who possibly committed crimes against humanity," I reply. "And even becoming Mother Teresa wouldn't erase that. He waited over half a century to confess? That's not inherent goodness. It's procrastination." "So you believe people can't change? That once you do a bad thing, you're a bad person?" "I don't know," I admit. "But I do think some stains never wash out." I glance at her. "Other people in town, they knew your family was Jewish?"
"Yes."
"And Joseph picked you to confess to. You aren't an individual to him any more now than a Jew was over 65 years ago."
"Or maybe he picked me because he thinks of me as his friend."
"Do you really believe that?" I ask, and Sage doesn't reply. "To be forgiven, the person has to be sorry. In Judaism, that's called teshuva. It means turning away from evil. It's not a one-time deal either, it's a course of action. A single act of repentance is something that makes the person who committed the evil feel better, but not the person against whom evil was committed." I shrug. "That's why Jews don't just go to confession and say the rosary."
"Joseph says he's already made his peace with God."
I shake my head. "You don't make peace only with God, you make it with people. Sin isn't global, it's personal. If you do wrong to someone, the only way to fix that is to go to that same person and do right by him, which is why murder to a Jew is unforgivable." She's quiet for a moment.
"Have you ever had someone walk into your office and confess to you?"
"No."
"Then maybe Joseph is different," Sage says.
"Did he come to you because he wants to make himself feel better, or because he wants to make his victims feel better?"
"Obviously that's not possible," she replies.
"And that makes you feel badly for him?"
"I don't know. Maybe."
I focus my attention on the road. The German people have paid billions of dollars of reparations to individuals, to Israel. But you know what? It's been nearly 70 years and they've never held a public forum to apologize to Jews for the crimes of the Holocaust. It's happened elsewhere. South Africa, for example. But the Germans? They had to be dragged by the Allies into the Nuremberg trials. Officials who had helped build the Third Reich stayed on in government after the war just by denying they were ever Nazis, and the German people accepted it. Young people today in Germany who are taught about the Holocaust brush it off, saying it's ancient history. So no, I don't think you can forgive Joseph Weber. I don't think you can forgive anyone who was involved. I think you can only hold them accountable and try to look their children and grandchildren in the eye without blaming them for what their ancestors did. Sage shakes her head.
Surely there were some Germans who were better than others, some who didn't want to go along with what Hitler said. If you can't see them as individuals, if you can't forgive the ones who ask for it, doesn't that make you just as bad as any Nazi?
No, I admit. It makes me human. Minka Singer is a tiny woman with the same snapping blue eyes as her granddaughter. She lives in a small condo and has a part-time caretaker who moves like a shadow around her employer, handing her reading glasses and her cane and a sweater before she can seemingly even think to ask for them. Contrary to what Sage indicated, She is absolutely thrilled to be introduced to me.
So tell me again, she says as we settle on the couch in her living room. Where did you meet my granddaughter?
Through work, I answer carefully.
Then you know how she bakes, yes? A person could get used to that kind of food all the time.
You'd have to have a lifetime deal with Jenny Craig, I reply. And then I realize why Minka has been so happy to meet me. She wants me to date her granddaughter. I'm not gonna lie. The thought of that makes me feel like I've been zapped by a bolt of electricity.
Grandma, Sage interrupts, Leo didn't come all this way to talk about my bread. You know what my father used to say? True love is like bread. It needs the right ingredients, a little heat, and some magic to rise.
Sage turns beet red. I cough into my hand. Miss Singer, I've come here today because I'm hoping you'll tell me your story.
Ah, Sage, that was meant for your eyes only. The silly fairy tale of a young girl, that's all.
I have no idea what she's talking about. I work for the United States government, ma'am. I track down perpetrators of war crimes. The light goes out of Minka Singer's eyes.
I have nothing to say.
Daisy, she calls out.
Daisy, I'm very tired. I'd like to lie down.
I told you so, Sage murmurs. From the corner of my eye, I see the caretaker approaching. Sage is lucky, I say. My grandparents aren't alive anymore. My grandpa, he came here from Austria. Every year he held a big backyard party on July 22nd. He'd have beer for the grown-ups and an inflatable pool for us kids, and the biggest cake my grandmother could make. I always assumed it was his birthday. It wasn't until I was 15 that I learned he'd been born in December. July 22nd, that was the day he became a U.S. citizen. By now, Daisy had reached Minka's side and has her hand beneath the woman's frail arm to help her stand. Minka rises and takes two shuffling steps away from me. My grandfather fought in World War II, I continue, getting to my feet. Like you, he never talked about anything he'd seen. But when I graduated from high school, he took me to Europe as a graduation gift. We visited the Colosseum in Rome and the Louvre in Paris, and we hiked in the Swiss Alps. The last country we visited was Germany. He took me to Dachau. We saw the barracks and the crematoria where the bodies of prisoners who had died were burned. I remember a wall with a ditch below it angled away to catch the blood of prisoners who were shot. My father told me that immediately after visiting the concentration camp, we would be leaving the country, because I was going to want to kill the first German I saw. Minka Singer looks back over her shoulder. There are tears in her eyes.
My father promised me I would die with a bullet to the heart.
Sage gasps, stricken. Her grandmother's eyes flicker toward her.
There were dead people everywhere. You had to walk on them sometimes to get away. So we saw things. A bullet in the head. There were always brains coming out. And it scared me. But a bullet in the heart, that didn't seem so bad by comparison. So that was the deal my father made me.
I realize in that instant the reason Minka has never spoken of her experience during the war is not that she has forgotten the details. It's because she remembers every last one, and wants to make sure that her children and grandchildren do not have to suffer the same curse. She sits back down on the couch.
I don't know what you want me to say.
I lean forward and take her hand. It's cool and dry like tissue paper.
Tell me more about your father, I suggest.
Part 2. When I grow up and reach the age of 20, I'll set out to see the enchanting world. I'll take a seat in a bird with a motor. I'll rise and soar high into space. I'll fly, sail, hover over the lovely faraway world. I'll soar over rivers and oceans. Skyward shall I ascend and blossom, a cloud my sister, the wind my brother. written by Avraham Koplovich, born 1930. He was a child in the Łódź ghetto. He was taken from the ghetto on the final transport to Auschwitz-Birkenau in 1944 and was murdered there at age 14.
What they had told me of the Upyur couldn't be true. The whip wielded by Damien had lashed open Alex's back so that his skin hung in ribbons and he was bleeding. How could a monster with no blood of his own do that? Not that it mattered. The crowd had turned out to watch the punishment, to revel in the pain of the creature that had caused them so much misery. In the moonlight, sweat gleamed on Alex's body, twisting in agony as he strained against his bonds. The villagers threw water in his face, vinegar and salt in his wounds. A light snow fell, blanketing the square. A bucolic picture postcard, except for the brutality at its center. "Please," I begged, breaking free from the soldiers who were restraining the onlookers so that I could grab Damien's arm. "You have to stop."
"Why? He wouldn't have. 13 people have died. 13.
He jerked his head at a soldier who caught me around the waist and held me back. Damien lifted the whip again and sent it whizzing through the air, cracking against Alex's flesh. It didn't matter, I realized, if Alex was even to blame. Damien knew the village simply needed a scapegoat. The cat's eye tail had opened a gash along Alex's cheek. His face was unrecognizable. His shirt hung in shreds at his waist as he sagged to his knees.
"Anya," he gasped, "go away."
"You bastard," Damien shouted. He hit Alex so hard in the face that blood sprayed like a fountain from his nose, that his head snapped back on the stalk of his neck.
"You could have hurt her."
"Stop," I shrieked. I stomped as hard as I could on the foot of the soldier who was restraining me and threw myself on top of Alex.
"You'll kill him,"
I sobbed. Alex was limp in my arms. A muscle jumped along Damien's jaw as he watched me try to bear the weight.
"You can't kill something," he said coldly, "that's already dead."
Suddenly, a soldier burst through the seam of the crowd, skidding in the snow to salute Damien.
"Captain, there's been another murder."
The villagers parted, and two soldiers stepped forward, carrying the body of Baruch Beiler's wife. Her throat had been torn out. Her eyes were still open.
"The taxman, he's missing," one soldier said.
I stepped forward as Damien knelt beside the victim. The woman's body was still warm, the blood still steaming. This had happened moments ago, while Alex was here, being beaten. I turned back, but the ropes that had held him a moment ago were slack, curled on the snow like vipers. In the blink of an eye, all the time it took the murmuring crowd to realize that a man was wrongly accused, Alex had managed to escape.
Minka. My father trusted me with the details of his death. "Minka," he would say in the hot summer, "make sure there is lemonade at my funeral. Fresh lemonade for all." When he dressed up in a borrowed suit for my sister's wedding, my father said, "Minka, at my funeral, you must be sure I look as dapper as I do today." This upset my mother to no end. "Abram Levin," she would say, "you're going to give the girl nightmares." But my father, he would just wink at me and say, "She is absolutely right, Minka. And for the record, no opera at my funeral. I hate opera. But dancing, now that would be nice." I was not traumatized by these conversations, as my mother thought. How could I be, knowing my father? He owned a very successful bakery, and I had grown up watching him load loaves into a brick oven in his undershirt, his muscles flexing. He was tall and strong and invincible. The real joke behind the joke was that my father was too full of life to ever die. After school, I would sit in the shop and do my homework while my older sister, Basha, sold the bread. My father didn't let me work at the cash register because school was more important to him. He called me his little professor because I was so smart. I had skipped 2 grades and passed a 3-day exam last year to get into gymnasium. It had been a shock to find out that even though I qualified, I was not accepted to the school. They only took 2 Jews that year. My sister, who had always been a little jealous of the premium placed on my intelligence, pretended to be upset, but I knew deep down she was happy that finally I would have to work a trade, just like her. However, one of my father's customers intervened. My father was such an accomplished baker that beyond the challah and the rye and the loaves that every Jewish housewife bought daily, he had special clients who were Christian, who came in for his babka and his poppy seed cake and mazurek. It was one of these clients, an accountant, who intervened so that I could attend the Catholic high school. During religious hour, I would be excused from class to do my homework in the hall with the other Jewish girl who attended. Then after school, I would walk to my father's bakery in Łódź. When the shop closed, Basha would go home to her newlywed husband, Rubin, and my father and I would walk through the streets to our house in a neighborhood mixed with Christians and Jews. One evening, as we were walking, a phalanx of soldiers marched past us. My father pushed me into the hollow made by a doorframe to let them pass. I did not know if they were SS or Wehrmacht or Gestapo. I was a silly girl of 14 who didn't pay attention to that. All I knew was that they never smiled, and they moved only at right angles. My father started to shield his eyes from the setting sun and then realized that his gesture looked like a heil, their greeting. So he pulled his arm down to his side. "At my funeral, Minka," he said without a hint of laughter in his voice, "no parades." I was spoiled. My mother, Hannah, cleaned my room and did all the cooking. When she wasn't fussing over me, she was needling Basha to make her a grandmother already, even though my sister had only been married for 6 months to the boy she'd been in love with since she was my age. I had friends in my neighborhood. One girl, Greta, even went to my school. Sometimes she invited me to her home to play records or listen to the radio, and she was perfectly nice. But in school, if we passed in the hall, she never made eye contact with me. That's just the way it was. Polish Christians did not like Jews, at least not in public. The Szymańskis, who lived in the other half of our building and invited us for Christmas and Easter, when I would stuff myself with non-kosher food, never looked down on us because of our religion. But my mother said that's because Mrs. Szymański was not a typical Pole, but rather was born in Russia. My best friend was Daria Horowicz. We had been in school together until I passed the entrance exams, but Daria and I still managed to see each other most every day and fill in all the details we'd missed about each other's lives. Daria's father owned a factory outside the city, and sometimes we would take a horse and buggy out there to have picnics by the lake. There were always boys buzzing around Daria. She was beautiful. A tall and graceful ballet dancer, with long, dark eyelashes and a little bow of a mouth. I was nowhere near as pretty as she was, but I figured the boys who buzzed around Daria couldn't all have her as their girlfriend. There would be some heartbroken fellow left over for me. And maybe he would be so taken with my wit that he wouldn't notice my crooked front tooth or the way my belly pooched out a tiny bit in the front of my skirt. One day, Daria and I were in my bedroom, working. We had a grand plan, and it involved the book that I was writing. Daria was reading it, chapter by chapter, and making corrections with a red pen, which was what we thought an editor would do. We were going to move together to London and live in a flat, and Daria would work at a publishing house, and I would write novels. We'd have fancy cocktails and dance with handsome men. In our world, Daria said, throwing aside the chapter she was marking up, there will be no semicolons. It was one of our favorite pastimes, reimagining a world run by Daria and myself that was perfect. A place where you could eat as many Kaiser rolls as you wanted without getting fat. A place where no one took mathematics in school. A place where grammar was an afterthought instead of a necessity. I looked up from the notebook in which I was scribbling. Seems indecisive, doesn't it? Either be a period or be a comma, but make up your mind. The chapter I had been working on for the past hour was only a few sentences long. Nothing was coming to me. And I knew why. I was too tired to be creative. My parents had been fighting last night and woke me up. I could not hear all of their argument, but it was about Mrs. Szymański. She had offered to hide my mother and me, if need be, but couldn't take all of us. I didn't understand why my father was so upset. It wasn't as if my mother and I would ever think of leaving him. In our world, I said, everyone will have an automobile with a radio. Daria flipped onto her belly, her eyes lighting up. Don't remind me. Last week, we had seen an automobile pull up to Vodoshpat, a fancy restaurant where once I had seen a movie star. When the driver got out of the car, we could hear music wafting from the inside, seeping into the air, and lingering like perfume. It was a wonder to think about having music with you as you traveled. On that day, I had also noticed a new sign on the restaurant. Psi I Gigi? Nie pozwolono. No dogs or Jews allowed. We had heard stories of Kristallnacht. My mother had a cousin whose shop had been burned to the ground in Germany. One of our neighbors had adopted a boy whose parents had been killed in a pogrom. Reuben kept begging my sister to go to America, but Basha wouldn't leave my parents behind. When she told them that we should move into the Jewish area of the city before things got worse, my father said she was too excitable. My mother pointed to the beautiful wooden buffet table, which must have weighed 300 pounds, and which had belonged to my great-grandmother. "How can you grab a suitcase and pack up your life?" she asked my sister. "You'd leave all your memories behind." I know Daria was remembering that sign on the restaurant, too, because she said, "In our world, there will be no Germans." Then she laughed. "Ah, poor Minka, you look like you're going to be sick at the very thought. But then, a world without Germans is a world without Herr Bauer." I put aside the notebook and inched closer to Daria. Today, he called on me 3 times. I'm the only one he picked more than once to answer a question.
That's because you raised your hand every time.
That was true. German was my best subject in school. We had a choice of taking French or German, The French teacher, Madame Genière, was an old nun with a giant wart on her chin that had hairs growing out of it. On the other hand, the German teacher, Herr Bauer, was a young man who looked a little like the actor Leon Liebgold, if you squinted or just daydreamed excessively, as I was wont to do. Sometimes, when he leaned over my shoulder to correct gender agreement on my paper, I would fantasize how he might take me in his arms and kiss me and tell me we should run away together. As if that would ever happen between a teacher and a student, or a Christian and a Jew. But he was easy on the eyes at the very least, and I wanted him to notice me, so I took every class he offered. German grammar, conversation, literature. I was his star pupil. I met with him during lunch just to practice. "Glauben Sie, dass es regnen wird, Fräulein Levin?" he would ask. "Ach ja, ich denke, wir sollten schlechtem Wetter rechnen." "Oh yes, I think we should expect bad weather." Sometimes he would even share a private joke with me in German. "Noch eine langweilige Besprechung." "Yet another boring meeting," he would say in passing, smiling pleasantly as he marched beside Father Yankovyak down the hall, knowing that the priest could not understand a word he was saying, but that I did. "Today, I made him blush," I confided, smiling. "I told him I was writing a poem and asked him how you might say in German, 'He took her in his arms and kissed her breath away.' I was hoping maybe he'd show me instead of tell me." "Ugh!" Daria shuddered. "The thought of a German kissing me makes my skin crawl." "You can't say that. Herr Bauer, he's different. He never talks about the war. He's far too much of a scholar for that. Besides, if you lump them all together because they're German, how does that make you any different from the way they lump us all together just because we're Jews?" Daria picked up a book from my nightstand. "Oh, Herr Bauer," she cooed, "I'll follow you to the ends of the earth, to Berlin. Oh, wait, that's the same thing, isn't it?" She mashed the book up against her face and pretended to kiss it. I felt a flash of annoyance. Daria was lovely, with her long neck and her dancer's body. I didn't make fun of her when she strung along several boys at once who'd flock around her at parties and vie for the honor of getting her some punch or a sweet. "It's just as well," she said, tossing the book aside. "If you start running around with a German professor, you're going to break Josek's heart." Now it was my turn to blush. Josek Shapiro was the one boy who didn't look twice at Daria. He'd never asked me to take a walk with him, or complimented me on a sweater or how I fixed my hair. But the last time we had gone on a picnic to the lake near the factory, he had spent a whole hour talking to me about my book. He had recently been hired by the Chronicle to write and was almost 3 years older than I was. But he didn't seem to think it was foolish to believe I could one day be published. "You know," Daria said, pointing to the pages she had been reading, "this is really just a love story." "So what's wrong with that?" "Well, a love story? That's no story at all. People don't want a happy ending. They want conflict. They want the heroine to fall for the man she can never have." She grinned at me. "I'm just saying that Anya's boring." At that, I burst out laughing. "She's based on you and me." "Then maybe we're boring." Daria sat up, crossing her legs. "Maybe we need to make ourselves more cosmopolitan. After all, I could be the kind of lady who'd drive to a restaurant in a car with a radio." I rolled my eyes. Right. And I'm the Queen of England.
Daria grabbed my hand. Let's do something shocking. Fine, I replied. I won't hand in my German homework tomorrow. No, no. Something worldly. She smiled. We could have schnapps at the Grand Hotel.
I snorted. Who's going to serve two little girls?
We won't look like little girls. Can't you steal something from your mother's closet?
My mother would kill me if she found out.
I won't tell her if you don't, Daria said, reading my mind.
I won't have to tell her.
My mother had a sixth sense. I swear, she must have had eyes in the back of her head to be able to catch me sneaking a taste of the stew from the pot before dinner was served, or to know when I was working on my story in my bedroom instead of doing my homework. When she has nothing else to worry about, she worries about me. Suddenly, from the living room, there was a shriek. I scrambled to my feet and ran, Daria at my heels. My father was clapping Reuben on the back, and my mother was embracing Basha.
Hanna, my father crowed to her, this calls for some wine.
Minusha, my mother said, using her pet name for me. She looked happier than I had ever seen her. Your sister is having a baby. It had been strange when my sister moved out after her wedding, so that I had my own room. It was stranger now to think of her as somebody's mother. I hugged Basha and kissed her on the cheek.
Oh, there's so much to do, my mother said.
Basha laughed.
You have some time, Mama. You can never be too prepared. We'll go out shopping tomorrow for yarn. We must start knitting. Abram, you'll make do without her at the cash register, which you know is not a good job for a woman who's expecting, standing there all day long with her back hurting and her feet swollen. My father exchanged a look with Reuben.
This could be a vacation, he joked. Maybe for the next 5 months she'll be too busy to bother complaining about me.
I glanced at Daria, who smiled and raised her brows. We looked like two children playing dress-up. I was wearing one of my mother's silk dresses and a pair of Daria's mother's pumps, and the kitten heels kept getting stuck between the cobblestones on the street. Daria had done up my face with makeup, which was supposed to make us look older, but which made me feel like a painted clown. The Grand Hotel rose above us like a wedding cake, with tiers upon tiers of windows. I imagined the stories going on behind each one. The two people in silhouette on the second floor were newlyweds. The woman staring out from the third-floor corner suite was remembering her lost love, whom she would meet for coffee later that afternoon, for the first time in 20 years.
So, Daria asked, aren't we going in?
As it turned out, it was even more difficult to actually go into the hotel pretending to be someone else than it was to gather enough bravery to walk there in our fancy clothes.
What if we see someone we know?
Who are we going to see? Daria scoffed. The fathers are all getting ready to go for evening prayers. The mothers are home getting dinner ready. I glanced at her.
You first.
My mother thought I was at Daria's, and Daria's mother thought she was at my house. We could easily get caught, but we were hoping our adventure would compensate for whatever punishment we might incur. As I hesitated, a woman swept up the stairs of the hotel past me. She smelled strongly of perfume and had nails and lips painted fire engine red. Her clothes were not as fine as those of the clientele of the hotel, or the man she was with, for that matter. She was one of those women,
the ones my mother pulled me away from. Women of the night were more common in Bawuchi, the poorer section of the city. Women who looked like they never slept, their shawls wrapped around their bare shoulders as they peeked from their windows. But that didn't mean there was a lack of loose women here. The man walking behind this one had a tiny mustache like Charlie Chaplin and a walking cane. As she sailed through the hotel doorway, he cupped his hand on her bottom.
"That's disgusting," Daria whispered. "That's what people are going to think we are if we go inside," I hissed.
Daria pouted.
"If you weren't going to go through with this in the first place, Minka, I don't know why you said..." "I never said anything. You said that you wanted..."
"Minka?" At the sound of my name, I froze. The only thing worse than my mother discovering I was not at Daria's house was someone recognizing me and running back to tell my mother. Grimacing, I turned around to see Josek, dapper in his coat and tie.
"It is you," he said, smiling,
and he didn't even steal a glance at Daria.
"I didn't realize you came here."
"What's that supposed to mean?" I asked, guarded. Daria elbowed me.
"Of course we come here. Doesn't everyone?"
Josek laughed.
"Well, I don't know about everyone. The coffee's better elsewhere."
"What are you doing here?" I asked. He lifted a notebook.
"An interview. A human interest piece. That's all they let me do so far. My editor says I have to earn breaking news."
He looked at my dress, pinned in the back because it was too big, and the borrowed shoes on my feet.
"Are you going to a funeral?"
So much for looking sophisticated.
"We're headed out on a double date," Daria said. "Really?" Josek replied, surprised. "I didn't think..."
Abruptly he stopped speaking.
"You didn't think what?" "That your father would let you go out with a boy," Josek said. "Clearly, that's not the case." Daria tossed her hair. "We're not babies, Josek."
He grinned at me.
"Then maybe you'd like to come out with me sometime, Minka. I'll prove to you that the coffee at Astoria puts the Grand Hotel to shame." "Tomorrow at 4, Daria announced, as if she was suddenly my social secretary. "She'll be there."
As Josek said his goodbyes and walked off, Daria looped her arm through mine.
"I'm going to kill you,"